Welcome to the official SBGAN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Noisley.
Hello, everybody. It's JPGN Journal Club time again with our principal interviewee and article selector, Dr. Jake Mann. Jake, how the heck are you?
Good, thanks. Looking forward to Easter. How are you, Alex?
Just fine. Running short on eggs, but otherwise just fine. Anyhow, we're glad to be back. We hope that you're glad to have us back. Two articles today. One of them is by Ricciuto et al. From Alimentation and Pharmacological Therapy. Oral vancomycin is associated with improved inflammatory bowel disease clinical outcomes in primary sclerosing cholangitis-associated inflammatory bowel disease. This is a matched analysis from the Pediatric PSC Consortium, which includes 54 centers, 1,362 PSC patients, 1,061 PSC IBD patients, and, building to an anticlimax, 113 PSC patients actually studied. Mind you, this is only about bowel disease and not about progression of the liver disease itself. In matched cohorts, vancomycin recipients' endoscopic and clinical biochemistry indices of IBD were substantially better than those of controls. No mention of how, quote, liver numbers, close quote, responded. I think this makes sense, Jake. You've got fewer bacteria in the gut, you've got less inflammation. It seems reasonable enough, but I know you can pick some holes in it, so have at it.
Absolutely. It does seem reasonable enough. I think it's an important and interesting paper coming out of this big international pediatric PSC consortium. This group has made major advances in our understanding of PSC and PSC-associated inflammatory bowel disease over the last few years. And I think it's a great example of multiple investigators, multiple centers working together to do really high-quality research on what is a relatively rare diagnosis in the general population, but is a huge problem for us because there is no effective therapy for PSC in adults or children. And the IBD associated with PSC is typically more severe than the IBD not associated with PSC. So this is the latest paper coming out from their group. And what I like is that they've tried to take a focus on the efficacy of vancomycin and looked on its impact on the IBD. And that really is a follow-up from, they did a matched analysis a few years ago. A paper came out in Hepatology comparing vancomycin to ursodeoxycholic deoxycholic acid to observation in patients with PSC.
Wait a minute. I'm getting foggy here.
Yeah.
Just because I'm not sure what exactly a matched analysis is.
So a matched analysis is where you have a retrospective cohort, typically retrospective, and that is a non-randomized, relatively non-selected. So typically you take all the individuals with condition X, in this case PSC, at a center, and then they would all be included in this retrospective analysis.
Okay.
But then if you want to have a specific focus of the study, you would say we will select, in this case, 70 patients who were treated with vancomycin, and to kind of do a pseudo randomized controlled trial study, you will match their characteristics to controls who didn't receive vancomycin but otherwise had other similar characteristics. And here really the key metric was severity of inflammatory bowel disease at diagnosis and the time of inflammatory bowel disease they'd had from diagnosis to the time when vancomycin was initiated.
So wait a minute, this is the severity at the time of initial diagnosis and not severity at the time that the doctor said, we have to do something, let's try vancomycin.
Correct. That was how it was primarily matched. And the most important fact that they matched for was the duration of inflammatory bowel disease at the start of when vancomycin was treated, and therefore they made a group which had, in theory, a diagnosis of IBD for the same duration.
Well, okay. Duration, so it starts out at one level, and then one person burbles along, not doing particularly badly, and another person who starts at the same level goes whoop downhill, and at the time, and really forces her doctor's hands by saying, we have to give this girl something. Here's the vancomycin. Let's give it a try. That means you might be selecting for a vancomycin treatment group who were the same at the beginning. And have I got lost in all this somehow, Jake?
I think that's accurate. The table one that compares the patient characteristics between the vancomycin treated and controls would suggest that those groups were exceptionally similar at the point of analysis. Mm-hmm. The only difference is that the controls had a slightly higher proportion of ulcerative colitis, whereas the vancomycin treated group had a higher proportion of Crohn's disease. Mm-hmm. And then the other standout difference is that in the controls, 17% had had a liver transplant, whereas zero of the vancomycin treated had had a liver transplant.
Whoa, 17%. Hmm. What that's a wonky set of numbers. What's wrong with those kids?
Well, we know that unfortunately, up to 30% of pediatric patients who develop PSC will need a liver transplant within a decade of their diagnosis. So having a liver transplant is not uncommon. It just seems a bit strange to have a zero in the vancomycin-treated group and a non-insignificant percentage in the control group. The authors have tried to adjust for this in their analysis by doing what's called a sensitivity analysis. So you, for example, take out all the patients who've had a liver transplant and see if that changes the result, i.e. the fact that the vancomycin made their inflammatory bowel disease better. And the presence of those individuals who'd had a liver transplant did not affect the result. It still just makes me wonder if there perhaps was a difference in the two groups.
There's no room for inferring that vancomycin might have a protective effect or an ameliorating effect on liver disease?
Well, so the previous study from this group would suggest that there was no evidence in their analysis that vancomycin had any benefit over observation or acetylsalicylic acid alone. It isn't harmful. I suppose my feeling is that PSC is a condition that waxes and wanes, and oral vancomycin therapy, at least to my understanding, is relatively safe and well tolerated. Mm-hmm. And like with almost all interventions, there will be a subgroup who respond, but pulling that data out can be really challenging. And I think that what this paper here has tried to do is to say that at the moment there isn't good evidence that vancomycin therapy is harmful or beneficial for the liver, but it might be beneficial for the IBD. And therefore, if a clinician decided to do a trial of it, it's not an unreasonable thing to do.
What are the steps that would lead you in your personal practice to say it's vancomycin time?
I think a patient who had persistently, significantly abnormal liver enzymes, where we were confident that there was no evidence of classical autoimmune hepatitis activity as well. So, for example, you weren't going to trial any immunosuppression. Then a short-term treatment of vancomycin may be beneficial. I think the main thing you'd want to counsel the families about is risk of multi-resistant GI bacteria. You'd feel very bad if they generated vancomycin-resistant enterococcus and then became unwell post-transplant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Jake, I very rarely see a liver biopsy specimen from a patient who's got only PSC without a little bit of smoldering. Could be autoimmune hepatitis. What are you relying on to say this patient is autoimmune hepatitis free?
a challenging composite analysis. I suppose you would want them to have plumb normal immunoglobulins. You'd want to make sure that they had no other autoantibodies that would be typically associated with autoimmune hepatitis. As you say, there is always some features on the biopsy that tends to be reported to say that there is inflammatory activity that could be associated with autoimmune hepatitis.
You're quoting from my reports. Okay.
Yeah, so it is challenging, but equally we know that there's been recent natural history studies that patients with type 1 autoimmune hepatitis, typically as pediatric diagnosis of type 1 autoimmune hepatitis, tend to evolve into a PSC phenotype as adults. So it does depend where you catch them in this process. But this cohort here that's really been described is said to be a classical PSC non-autoimmune hepatitis cohort.
PSC pure, got it. That is a lot to take on board. But we have another paper to get to. And that is closer to Espigan, because it's published in this month's edition of the journal. It's Florence Lacaille. Coucou Florence, ça va? Awareness, referral, and age at Kasai Surgery for Biliary Atresia in Europe. A survey of the quality of care task force of Espigan. 26 European hepatology centers, that's between 20,000, oh my gosh, I can't read numbers anymore, between 2015 and 2019, 785 children with extrahepatic biliary atresia were seen at these centers. We know that the goal for the out in the community pediatrician or primary caregiver is to detect jaundice by age 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and then to bundle that baby off to a pediatric hepatologist, gastroenterologist. The reality is 55 days. That's not great. And then once they get into the hands of a hepatologist, gastroenterologist, then bang, 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 61 days, hepatic portoenterostomy is the average. But still, that's just one day. Only one day, but still, after the 60-day end of the period during which one reasonably can hope for good results. They took a look as well in Florence's home territory. They sent out a SurveyMonkey request, and 392 French pediatricians bothered to respond. 20% of the surveyed population. The questions asked were, effectively, we now have stool color cards. Has their presence made any difference to how you handle infantile cholestasis? Possibly, was the answer. Do you use the cards? Do you feel that you understand cholestasis in infants? Frankly, no. Well, it's too early to say if referral in France and portoenterostomy results are going to improve as a result of this introduction. Of interest to me, working in Austria, is that we're not using them here. I don't know why. Jake, how is referral different in Britain from the referral pattern seen in France? How is it different from the overall referral pattern seen in this survey?
Well, in the UK, there are three defined national centres for paediatric liver disease. So that does mean that our three centres do have a relatively high volume compared to other countries where there may be more centres doing Kasai's. But as you've said, the rate-limiting step here is the time to referral. And the thing that I suppose struck me was that really rapid from referral, mean of 55 days to Kasai, mean of 61 days. But if you're having patients referred 55 days, it's quite hard to bring down the overall mean age at Kasai. And bringing down the overall mean My interpretation of the data is that it should be thought of as a continuum rather than a cutoff at 60 days, such that I appreciate that there are some different opinions on this, but at least my interpretation is that a Kasai done at 40 days is better than that done at 45, which is better than that done at 50. So even an incremental gain in, let's say, 5 days or so across Europe may well then have a knock-on effect on the number of transplants needing to be done in the pediatric age group.
That's all very well, but you haven't answered my question as to what's it like in Britain?
Well, in Britain, I think that there is a relatively rapid turn from seeking advice from a specialist liver centre. And I think one UK centre certainly was included in this group. I do not have the UK numbers to hand of what the actual mean age of Kasai referral is. I know our centre in Birmingham, it is typically significantly lower than a mean age of 55 days at the point of referral. But I wonder whether the fact that there is such a subspecialisation means that patients are quite rapidly passed on from family doctor to general paediatrician to hepatologist for further investigation. But certainly the focus here did seem to be the perhaps delay or the relatively slow recognition in the first instance rather than by the specialists.
For sure. So I had it explained to me that in Germany, for example, you don't refer patients outside your local insurance organization, your local Krankenkasse, which is federal state by federal state, sort of a duplication of the United States dreadful approach, which is that everybody gets to do 3 Kasais a year and none of them is done well. But that has to do more with outcome than with referral patterns. There's been a lot of attempts to train pediatricians to say this baby is yellow, it needs to be seen by a gastroenterologist rather than just saying, oh, it's breast milk jaundice, leave it alone, it'll get better. What's gone wrong in those attempts to educate the local docs?
I think we have to appreciate that we are talking about for what is an ultra-rare disorder for family doctors and a rare disorder for general paediatricians. It's generally quoted in the UK that most GPs will see one or perhaps 2 cases in their whole career, whereas we'll get a referral once every other week. And I think that means it's very hard to have that information of the importance from our perspective, and certainly from the patients and families' perspective, kept to the forefront of the mind of a family doctor who is seeing undifferentiated patients and seeing a huge number of diagnoses. Clearly, that doesn't mean that it's not important, but I think that that makes it very challenging. The other thing is that I think it is not uncommon to ask parents what the colour of the stool is. And if you only have 7 minutes to see a patient, or however long it is, if they don't have a stool right in front of you and you don't ask to see it, a parent may say, yes, the stool is yellow. But unless you physically see it, and then even sometimes not just the external surface, we have to kind of dig in a little bit to see the inside to truly confirm the colour. That is, you know, it takes some relatively specialist training to be familiar with doing that.
Well, whom are we trying to educate? Are we trying to educate the docs or are we trying to educate the visiting nurses? Maybe we're emphasizing training of the wrong people.
Or even the parents. So there is significant interest now in trying to develop applications, phone apps where is my baby's poo normal? An absolute classic question that's been asked by almost every single parent at some point, where they can just take a photo of their baby's poo on their phone and it compares, it has a database where it's previously compared normal and abnormal stools. And if they think it's abnormal, then they're more likely to seek intervention. That will be one option. And you know, I think that that is a really interesting avenue, which is kind of relatively low stress, perhaps, whereas the flip side would be, for example, a screening procedure where every baby has conjugated bilirubin measured at day 5 with their other screening bloods, which is an intervention which the authors of this paper do quote another study that's done that, and that did reduce the mean age at Kasai or mean age at referral in one region in the States, I believe. But we do have to bear in mind that that would be then a screening procedure for a condition that is rare, where the intervention is not completely effective. And if we're to weigh this up against the criteria for screening, then you'd want to have a well-defined treatment that is highly effective, that if put into place early would benefit. And I think that bilirubin probably does just about meet that criteria. But
well, I'm glad to hear you say that, because a little while ago you were saying, hey, 44 is better than 45, 43 better than 44. And now all of a sudden it was, I don't know. It sounds like we're not going to get anywhere with this. What we need, I suppose, is tell us about the Taiwan experience. They've been doing that for a while.
Yeah, so there are various other countries that have tried a whole number of different strategies to try and reduce the mean age at Kasai. And they found that there was in areas where the existing mean age of Kasai was under 60, 55-ish days, then putting all these other interventions in place didn't really tend to bring down the mean age of Kasai beyond that. But in centres where the mean age of Kasai was much higher, so over 60 days, then putting other interventions in place brought it down to about that. So there did seem to be, at least in other parts of the world, some kind of threshold of around 50 days. And perhaps that has something to do with the natural history of the condition and the variability in bilirubin.
I think that wraps it up, puts a ribbon around it and ties it in a bow. Jake, thank you so much for your time today, and thank you for taking the time to, thank you for going through these articles with us.
Thanks very much.